I love that we've been tracking through Philippians and exploring this sermon series. Adam and I kind of knocked it around just before I left, and I was a little bit bummed not to open it and be like, this is where we're going. But I really feel like God has been kind of teaching me just to let go and to just let him work in his people, because that's his job, right? And I get to partner with him in that. So we've trying to track to this point. We heard a great sermon from Conrad kind of overviewing the whole book about kind of where we are in the context and all of that. We then go on from Adam on the changed heart that we have, the real heart of stepping into our relationship with Jesus. And then Liz talked to us about our real purpose, the kingdom of God, this thing that we're all called to. And then finally, last week, we explored with the 5:30 congregation the real attitude change, the attitude adjustment, if you will, that Jesus is calling us to have the same attitude in our relationships to other people that he had in going to the cross, that we would lay ourselves down in exploration of his grace for the people that we love. Now tonight, we get to jump into the rubber hitting the road, the real responsibilities of the believer. Now that you're sat there saying, I'm in, let's do this thing. What do we do? What's the point of this whole thing, and how do we actually do it? Something I want to grab for us as we move and remind you of is what Paul is doing in this letter. Not theologically, but from his heart. Here is a church leader, an itinerant church leader, one that travels around and plants churches, writing a letter to a group of people, probably 40 people, let's be honest, in a city at the corners of the Roman Empire, well, probably in the middle of the Roman Empire, actually, Philippi at that point, full of people that he loves. Paul loves dearly and deeply the Philippian church. He knows them, he stayed with them, he cares for them, and he cares that they are in pain because he is imprisoned and suffering. And so Paul thus far has said, guys, I've heard this, I know this, I seek God's face for you every day, and you have to know that it's okay. That what is painful and suffering in our eyes, God has turned that thing around and caused good to grow out of the concrete from it, right? And that if I die, thank God I get to go and be with Jesus. And that if I live, I get to go and bless more communities the way that I blessed you. So be encouraged to keep loving each other the way Jesus loved you all when he went to the cross. And then we get into real responsibilities. And Paul is going to help us see our responsibility to ourselves and our faith, our world, and the church that we're a part of. And so I wonder, when you think about that word responsibility, what comes to mind? Maybe it's, I've got to get a job, or I've got to figure out that uni course, or I'm responsible for determining the thing that I'm going to do with the rest of my life, like figure out the path that I'm going to walk. I'm responsible for maybe the people that I love or that parking fine I got the other week. Have you ever thought about what it means for you to be responsible for your faith? I want you to turn to your neighbor, and just for 30 seconds now, first thing that comes to your mind, the thing that's kind of bubbling up, what does it mean to be responsible for your faith? Go. All right, I'm going to bring you back into the center now with me. I know that wasn't very long, but I don't want to keep you guys here all night. And nobody needs a 45-minute recording landing on Spotify tomorrow morning. So maybe you knocked around a couple of ideas there, and maybe you kind of heard some really beautiful things and some really grounded things. Maybe you got stuck on a bit of like Christianese or like very Christian or religious language, right? But Paul's going to lay it out for us here, but he's quite lofty in the way that he does it. So I'm going to kind of unpack it for us. But I want to contrast it, if I can, to the plight of our generation, if you will. We are a dissatisfied generation. We have record numbers of anxiety and all sorts of other fear into the future. I read just a little snapshot of a study in The Lancet a few months ago saying that 75% of young people are fearful of the future. We're dissatisfied about what we see coming. It frightens us and we don't get it. We think it should be better and we don't know why things have to be the way that they are. Right? Now, I'm aware that I'm a millennial, right? And if that's me, that's even more true for the Gen Zs in the room, right? Anyone under 25 at this point, that's even more true for you. And so millennials and Gen Zs, that's most of us, we've spent the last couple of years being really vocal about the fact that we're dissatisfied on both sides of the political spectrum, but also the cry of our heart, the justice cry. And you didn't have to look too far when October 7 hit the news for young people all over the world to be like, enough is enough. You didn't have to look too far as we approach the referendum on The Voice, and whatever you think about that, young people on both sides of the spectrum were going, this is going to work and we need it, and actually, like, this is just tokenistic and we don't need this. We're a generation that looks at the structures and the people in power and go, that's not good enough. Corruption exists in our political system and our political parties, and we go, that's not good enough. But we're also not satisfied with ourselves. We're not satisfied with the people that we are. We spend more than any other generation more money on self-improvement and like wellness industry stuff. And there's a beautiful part about that like we actually care about self-care. Like in my position, I see people in their 50s burning out in ministry and fracturing relationships in families. And I go, well, that ain't going to be me. Like, I'm not going to do that. But on the other side of it, we're almost addicted to self-improvement. Like, we know there's an itch that can't quite be scratched, that if we just get this job or we listen to that lecture or we read that book or we have that morning routine, we're going to be okay. Dissatisfaction lies at the heart of almost everything that we do. So we imitate the people that we think are getting it, only to see them plummet and burn later down the line and go, well, if that can happen to them, couldn't it happen to me? Something's not right. Not in our world. On our hearts, and if we're really honest with ourselves, I wonder if we'd be brave enough to say that something's not right with the way that we're experiencing our faith, because we read something like what Paul has just written to the Corinthians, that there's so much joy in his heart, there's no discontent in the way that he writes. We are talking about one of the most violent men in the New Testament. Saul of Tarsus, this man who hunted and persecuted the church, who dragged men and women and children out of their homes and put them to death or in prison, and never lost a minute's sleep over it because he knew he was God's man doing it. And then he comes face to face with the risen Jesus, and he is never, get this, he is never violent again. ever. Something radical has happened in his experience of what it is to follow the person of Jesus Christ. I wonder if we're honest with ourselves, how much we can say, man, I was this thing. And then, yeah, I'm like maybe a little cleaner on the outside, but in the inside, like this is just kind of still there. And maybe we're thinking, I feel like something's missing in my faith. And I want to hazard to say that some of us have been in like, I'm in, like, I want to do this, Jesus. Like, I want to follow you. I love it. I'm in. Thank you for the gift of grace in my life. And your way for my life is better. But something's just not quite sticking. And I would hazard to say that that thing is perhaps responsibility for our faith in the way that Paul is about to explain it here. My son, Micah, a lot of you know him, he loves responsibility to a point, right? He's 2.5, but he does not want to play by himself. He does not want to just do things that he thinks are fun by himself. He wants to help me make dinner. And so that takes heaps longer. And it's really annoying because he can't cut anything up by himself. So it's not like I can be like, all right, you cut the carrots and I'll get the water. But you can't do that. I could be like, all right, well, that would take me 20 minutes to make, but I need 45. But he loves and needs to partner with me in exploring the world. And that's what we need. In exploring our faith, we need responsibility. It's not good enough for us to just hear a sermon about how you're nothing or you're worthless, nothing you could ever do, but Jesus so all good. That's never sat right with me. That's a little reductionistic, but bear with me. I'm using hyperbole to make a point, right? It's not good enough for us to just be fed that week after week. Or any other version of it. And so what do we need? Well, we need responsibility, the kind of responsibility that in verse 12 works out our salvation with fear and trembling, comma. Remember that comma because we're going to come back to it. That's half a thought. We're going to get to the other half of the thought. But what on earth does that mean? Work out our salvation with fear and trembling. I thought salvation was like the free gift of grace that Jesus just gives me when I realize that he is the way, the truth, and the life through his mercy. What could it possibly mean for me to work that out? 15 seconds, 20 seconds now with your neighbor, what does it mean? What does it mean to work out your salvation with fear and trembling? Go. All right. I hope you managed to throw around a couple of good ideas there. I know I'm not giving you a lot of time, but we can definitely continue having these chats into the next, 150 years or so. So to work out our salvation with fear and trembling, I want to frame it like this. But first I want to say, if you have a discontent in your faith, perhaps even a righteous discontent, a holy frustration that this thing that is Christianity that you have been given doesn't really cut the mustard, I would hazard to say it's because we haven't done this yet. We haven't taken responsibility to work out our faith in fear and trembling. And the cool thing is, we get to tonight. So salvation, that's one of those kind of crazy words, right? Like, and I want to just kind of simplify it for us a little bit. What I don't think Paul is saying here is, you've got to go and earn that thing now, like go and get your salvation. Because what happens is in evangelical circles, which is, this is one of them, as soon as I say kind of what I can do as a believer, a lot of people freak out and they go, ah, works-based gospel. And like, that's not what we're talking about here, right? Like, we're just talking about the stuff that we are going to do. Like, Micah isn't actually making dinner. Like, he hasn't brought his own dinner. Like, I just let him, like, smush a carrot a little bit. Like, he's partnering with me, right? Now, thankfully, God, I think, thinks we're a little bit more competent than just a smush carrot, but not that much. But we're not talking about earning the gift here. We've been given the gift, right? So think about salvation as the freedom that you've been given in Jesus for his death and resurrection. Yeah? So it's the freedom that we have as believers when we say, all right, Jesus, I'm in. Like when I, this is my personal testimony, right? When I got to the end of my tether and it was a decision between continue to in the destructive way that I had been living or say yes to someone offering a way better alternative at this point, Jesus. Like all I did was lean into that rescue, right? I didn't do a thing. But now, Jesus goes, you've got some responsibility now to work out your salvation, your freedom with fear and trembling. Fear and trembling like you could fail. And that might feel weird. That might feel, oh, hang on, works-based gospel. But I want to say that I think it's possible to have a saved soul and a wasted life. You know, a friend of mine used to say, used to get a little bit frustrated in her moments and be like, oh God, why is it that I'm here and I'm serving in all of these ways and I'm sacrificing this and this and this. And then this person comes into your kingdom like right at the end of their life after living debaucherously and like a wastrel. And they get in. And her sense and from God was like, yeah, but look at all the beautiful good that we together will bring into the world and eternity. Like they'll get there and be like, wow, look at all of these cool things the church did. But I was never part of the church in my lifetime. There is a beautiful call on our life now to partner with God to bring goodness into the world. But we need to work out our salvation with fear and trembling. Explore the gift of freedom that is in your hands and hearts. Explore it every day for the rest of your life. Go, Jesus, what does this mean for my life? But as we do that, God is working in us to shift for us to will and act in accordance with his good purpose. That God would come into our lives and our hearts, the heart being like the core of our being, not my bum, 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 but the essence of who I am, that God would enter that place and work in us to see our desires and our actions be changed and transformed to his good purpose. He will partner with us in making us good as he makes us good so that we can step into his good purpose, part of which is to pour out love and good deeds on our community and the world. We've just come from Paul exhorting the Philippians to love one another like Jesus loved them going to the cross. That's God's good purpose, that we would lay down our lives for each other, that we would just bring good into the world. The kind of goodness that God set in the world before it was corrupted, that in the darkness, in suffering, in all of the things that we heard about in prayer tonight, that God would use and partner with us to make his goodness known in the world. And that is our responsibility, to partner with him to see that done. And we cannot do that and still be saved. It might be that we're walking down the street and we notice poverty for the first time, perhaps ever. We actually are confronted with the reality of it in our world, in our suburb, on our street. And I can't help but notice it. And now every day I notice it. So much so that I'm now compelled almost to do something about it. That saying yes, that doing something about it is your partnering with the Spirit. You could say no to that. You could quash that thing and say, I don't want that. Like, I don't have time. I'm too busy. And God's just going to keep going, hey, do you see the poor? Do you see the poor? Hey, look, there's the poor. You care about that. I know, because I'm working in you. Go and do something about it. Let's do it together. Partner with God to see his good purpose come forward in the world. And that, big picture, what Liz was talking about, is the kingdom of God going forth. A kingdom that is full of goodness, real goodness. Ordered relationships, like chiefly that goodness will be in the way that we relate to other people. Most of life is relating to other people, right? God wants all of that. That's why he says to us, lay yourselves down. Think of others more than you think of yourself. Go and do that. A kingdom of justice, of mercy, and of humility. A kingdom where corruption and injustice is like rooted out and chased after. And the cry of our generation to fix this is one that the church embodies, is one that you all are invited to embody, to prayerfully pursue. One of mercy, that in our own brokenness and the brokenness of people around us, we are met with love and restoration to community and family. And one of humility, that when we walk into a room, we think, how can I make the other people here look good? I just saw a production of Cats, the musical. I hate that musical so much. I hate it. But one of the main characters, they've all got weird names, I can't even remember their names. But one of the main characters was one of the most skillful and brilliant performers I have ever seen in my entire life. And I've been in theater, was in theater for like 10 years, right? She's young, she's like 19. And if she wants it, she could take it. But all she did on stage the whole time, she's a believer, was make everyone else look good. That's the call for you. You can be the most brilliant musician in the congregation. How do you make everyone else look good? You could be an incredible anything. How do you make everyone else look good, right? Apparently with an hour and a half sleep, my examples are pretty sparse. Now that's the kind of world that I want to live in, but it's also the kind of world I think our generation wants to live in. A generation that is sick and tired of people in the limelight all of a sudden being revealed to be corrupt, to being malevolent, or revealed to have a brokenness in them that they didn't know what to do with. But that has to start in us. A movement like that, that isn't going to work with just a group of people getting together and going, let's just outwardly subscribe to this thing and pretend to do it for a little bit, just so that the world will get on board. That's not how it works. I spent enough time as an undergraduate arts student in kind of the Socialist Alliance meetings and like the Australian Communist Party meetings to know, and I was like, yes, it's like rise of the proletariat, let's do it. But in the end, after reading the literature and confronting the truth, I was like, well, hang on a minute, like, I'm the bourgeois. Like, I've got a pretty cushy life. And I didn't really see anyone talking about this stuff, wanting to lay that down for this so-called rise of the proletariat. Now, I know a couple of people that went and sold everything they had and joined punk communities, and good on them, but I was never going to do that. So this thing that we were all trying to just like step into was never in us. We were just dissatisfied with the world and thought, violent overthrow, or insert whatever you want to insert into that space, right? But then I became a Christian, right? I was burned down to the absolute wick, and I became a Christian, and I jumped into like fundamentalist Pentecostalism. And I was in, like I drank the Kool-Aid. Like I was like young earth, like dinosaurs are a lie of the devil, and like, and all of it, right? And I don't mean to sound facetious, like if you believe that, like please come and chat to me after the service and I will unpack it, right? Because I think like, because I have believed it. But what I realize is that fundamentalism doesn't actually work out anything with fear and trembling. It just prescribes a new mandate. It prescribes an exact formula, so I don't have to do any working out. I just get to go, this is me now. But eventually, just like communism did, the fundamentalism was just like, this is just doesn't fit. This is just awkward, and I just don't think I... And so I had to leave that behind too. You see, prescription, be it the Communist Manifesto or fundamentalist theology, doesn't work anything out. And it's a luxury that Jesus doesn't give us. We have the responsibility to prayerfully partner with him in the context of our community, to work out our freedom, the gift of grace, every single day as we walk with him into the future. Now, that doesn't roll off the tongue as well, but that's the call. That is the invitation. But before you write the email, Workspace Gospel, remember that Paul's given us a couple of things to do here, right? Like, really what it means is that working out is other-focused. It's one that kind of looks to the other and goes, how do I make them look good? Look around the room. Just look around the room now. Is there anyone in this room that you have ever thought like, oh God, I just wish they didn't go to this church? Oh, yeah, we all, because we've done it, right? Like, we're human. Or have you gone, oh, it'd be so much easier if they didn't do this thing or that thing. Oh, their life is so annoying, right? That is not the way of Jesus. It's just not. And if you harbor that in your heart and you speak it with your kind of little in-group, you will have an unsatisfying faith. You just will. It'll just feel yucky. That's not very theological yucky, but that's just kind of how you're going to feel. Because this is the absolute opposite of what we're called to being other-focused. And Paul's going to say it right here. Do it all of that working out, and partnering with God without grumbling or arguing. Jeez, far out. All right, well, I guess I'll try again in the next life. That was a joke. Email. Reincarnation, no. The grumbling and arguing, it means that. It means the like, oh, this person. And it means that, well, I think the music should be this loud or that loud, or we should have 4 people in a band or 5 people in a band, or the light should be up or down, and letting those things come in between our love for one another. We work those things out, absolutely. It's not bad to have a different idea. We just work it out in love. And we go, what do you think of this? Oh, well, let's give it a try and see what happens. What do we really think? I mean, I liked it, but what do you guys reckon? Ah, nah, that was a bit silly. All right, now we'll go back to the other thing. That's how we do it in love, right? That's a bit reductionistic, but you kind of get the picture. But it's a bit bigger than that too, right? Grumbling is this idea of being like emotionally, like oppositional to the things of God. Like the poor. God really cares about the poor. Like maybe more than he cares about anything else. I don't know. There's probably a book there. I'm not going to write it. We can't say, "Bah, I don't need to care about the poor." That's grumbling. That's God going, "Mm-mm, don't Allah, don't pull yourself away from the heart of God." And the arguing is this kind of intellectual rebellion against God, even within our church communities. And I'll pick it up just because it's perhaps fresh for us. But we just did a whole series on stewardship. Like God says, be generous. He's like, that's what I want for you. Be generous. We don't get to go, I'm just going to keep it. I'm just going to keep it. That's not on the table. I'm going to keep all my time for myself. Like that's not an option. It's arguing with God. Like wrestle, sure. Be like, all right, God, how much time do you want? All right. And that's good. Just going, I'm just living my life, God, and I'll rock up for an hour and a half and try to stay awake. That's not so good. Because I think if you live like that, a faith like that, God's just like, come, man, come. Come, I'm inviting. But if we live out like that, I just don't think it's very satisfying. We kind of like drag ourselves reluctantly through this like rigid moralism at that point. We hear about this person that we could be if only we yielded to him as Lord, but we never be it. So, but why does this even matter? It's because you all and I and us together are called to be a people that can hold this beautiful gift of freedom out to the world as a better thing. And go, check me out exploring this beautiful gift. Doesn't it look good? Like that is an oasis in the desert of discontent and frustration and hopelessness and, as I heard it coined recently, sunny nihilism, as in there is no meaning, I guess we find our own, so long and thanks for all the fish, right? That's an oasis, that there is a God that calls us to live in exploration of that freedom. As we hold firmly to the truth of who Jesus is. The only atoning sacrifice for us coming back into relationship with the divine. And you might be sitting there thinking, yeah, that's why I'm annoyed, Cain. Because the church doesn't do this. This isn't the Christianity I've received. I have an issue with a couple of that thought a little bit. First of all, like the church isn't helpful. It's in me, though. I often catch myself going, hang on a minute. No, like the church is an unhelpful brush, right? It's like saying the musicians or like the atheists. It's not helpful because there's nuance in the body. There's nuance in our community, right? So it doesn't matter if the church isn't doing anything. We could do it. Like we could actually do it. The church at Philippi was probably like 40 people. We're about 40 people. Like we could actually do this. We could go, all right, let's do it. Let's take responsibility for working out our freedom like we could fail at it. Then we have to freak out because God's partnering with us to do it. We only failed by not trying to do it. Oh, and then we can hold that thing out to the world like it's better. As a group of people, as we kind of come into the end of our passage here, in verse 17,
that Paul says he's being poured out like a drink offering on the sacrifice and service of their lives. Right? So Paul is saying, I assume you guys are going to keep doing this. And if I have to be poured out like a drink offering to complete that thing, the sacrifice of your life, beautiful. Now, let me modernize the language so we're not freaking out about sacrifices and drink offering. I want you to picture Vin Diesel at the end of the Fast and the Furious films. He's holding his thing up and he's talking about the people they've lost and family and all of that. And he pours the drink out, right? The sacrifice that the people have lost, of the people that they've lost or aren't there, is completed by the pouring out of that drink. That's what a drink offering was in the pagan world. That's what the church at Philippi would have heard. Not Vin Diesel, but that's what it looks like. It's going, man, if I would say it, I would say, if my life has to be poured out and extinguished to complete the sacrifice and service, the all of you saying, let's work this out and actually doing it and actually walking that good thing out for the rest of your days, partnering with the Spirit, if my life had to be poured out for that thing, how beautiful that would be. That's kind of what Paul's saying here, right? But I'm not the Apostle Paul. In fact, what we draw from this is that we become a community of Paul's and Philippians. That for each and every one of the people that we love in the room, and that's everyone, because you have to love everybody Jesus loves, right? But you need to partner with God to know, like, how do I lay myself down for them? How do I pour myself out, God? Or how are you pouring me out so that they can partner with you to manifest beauty and goodness and truth in the world so that your kingdom grows? And that is the kind of community that I want to be a part of. The kind of community that I think our world wants to be a part of. And the kind of community that I want us to be. I wonder, do you want us to be that? Because I think if we become that or begin to become that, that will lead to the most satisfying, the most contented, and the most authentic expression of our lives that we could ever possibly have imagined. And we are responsible. We are responsible then to partner with God to work that out, to explore the good gift of grace that He's put on our lives, to make good manifest in the world in accordance with His kingdom, holding it out to the world to see that it's better, and being a people that lay themselves down for one another. And when we do all of that, Paul says, join me in rejoicing. What a beautiful, messy, a little bit scary life. But what a better alternative to basically anything else on offer. Not basically, anything else on offer. So that's where we're going, team. If you're new tonight and you're like, who is this guy? I'm sorry. But I'm also not. Because that's where I want us to be. And if you're new tonight, that's what this is. That's what we're about, becoming that. If you're not new tonight, but this is new to you, let's go, team. Let's do it.